is Friday, November 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, at least 34 people die in separate attacks in Pakistan.
So these attacks obviously are not a good sign for the new government, which is desperately trying to revive the troubled economy of the country.
Voters in Taiwan prepare to go to the polls for midterm local elections, and a new film portrays an unlikely friendship during the era of segregation in the Deep South. It's all ahead. It has been a violent day in Pakistan. Authorities in the southern city of Karachi say at least four people were killed when a group of three armed men carrying suicide vests attacked the Chinese consulate. The Baluch Liberation Army, a separatist group based in the southwestern province of Baluchistan, claim responsibility for the attack and release photos of the three bombers. Pakistani authorities said explosive materials and weapons were found in the assailants' car. Within a few hours of the Karachi attack, a powerful bomb ripped through a crowd of people in the northwestern Orakzai region, killing at least 30 people and wounding more than 40 others. Local officials and witnesses anticipated the casualty toll to rise. Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad tells me about both attacks, beginning with the one in Karachi.
Yeah, that was quite an unprecedented incident today because there hasn't been any attacks on the Chinese diplomatic missions in Pakistan. So this was like quite a shocking incident this morning when people woke up that early in the morning, three attackers heavily armed and carrying suicide vests, they tried to storm the consulate, Chinese consulate in Karachi. But, you know, there was very heavy deployment of both police and paramilitary forces. So they quickly engaged the attackers. And in the process, one of the assailants basically blew himself up to make sure that his other partners could enter the diplomatic mission. But then heavy gunfire prevented them from doing so. And within an hour, security forces were able to gun them down. Otherwise, it could have been really devastating for the Chinese because there were 21 Chinese staff inside the diplomatic mission, and they were all fully on job, working, issuing visas and taking care of other routine work. So had they been, and that's what Prime Minister Imran Khan, after the attack, said while condemning it, that had they managed to enter the facility, it would have been quite a devastating incident today.
And I believe there has been a claim of responsibility for this attack.
And that is, again, an unusual sort of claim because Baluch Liberation Army is a militant group which is waging insurgency in the southwestern Baluchistan province, you know, claiming that the federal government is basically depriving them of their legitimate rights over the mineral resources of that province. And they have been waging insurgency. They have been carrying out attacks in Baluchistan. But today, for the first time, one of these militant groups claimed responsibility, indicating that they have access and they can carry out attacks in other part of Pakistan other than the Baluchistan province. And basically, you know, the message that these groups, these militants wanted to send out is that they are not happy with Chinese investment of billions of dollars that is going to create an economic corridor. And most of the key projects of this corridor are located in Baluchistan province. And that's what the militant group in its statement said, that because they are not happy with China trying to invest and take away all their natural resources from Baluchistan, and they wanted to send a message that there will be more such attacks.
Well, then there was another attack as well in the northwest part of the country in the Orakzai region. What happened there?
Well, this was, again, in that area, it is not uncommon to have these kind of attacks. It is not clear at this moment whether the two incidents are linked, because that attack primarily happened in an area which is basically where the Shiite Muslims are in majority. And usually Sunni militants have carried out against Shiite Muslims, carried out attacks against Shiite Muslims in that part of Pakistan. And Shia-Sunni sectarian violence has been the hallmark of this Karzai agency. So the suspicion is that, again, it could be a traditional sectarian attack with Sunni militants planting this device that went off. And as of this moment, we know that It killed at least 30 people, and out of more than 50 injured, we know that several are still in critical condition. So it is, again, a bloody day for Pakistan. But these two incidents happened after quite some time. You know, there has been a lull in militant violence in Pakistan due to regular security operations all over the country. But these two attacks really shocked people all over Pakistan at a time when there's a lot of discussion going on how to revive the economy. And the new government led by Prime Minister Imran Khan has been striking new economic agreements with China and with Saudi Arabia and other countries in the region to try to revive the economy, because it's the violence, militant violence over the past many years that has really impacted economic development in Pakistan. So these attacks obviously are not a good sign for the new government, which is desperately trying to revive the troubled economy of the country.
Ayaz Ghul reporting from Islamabad. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Spain demands guarantees on Gibraltar before its endorsement of the Brexit deal. An attack on Friday prayers kills 26 people in Afghanistan. The United Arab Emirates says a British academic convicted as a spy could be freed. And U.S. shoppers are lining up outside Bargainville stores for this beginning of the Christmas holiday shopping season known as Black Friday. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
November 20th marked what could be considered the 20th anniversary of the International Space Station. It was on that day in 1998 that the Zarya functional cargo block, the first module of what would become the ISS, was launched into space atop a Russian rocket from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. According to NASA, Zarya, which means sunrise in Russian, was a self-contained unit that provided power, communications, and served as a temporary control room during the early construction phase of the ISS. It's now primarily used as a storage area. 16 days later, the Space Shuttle Endeavour, carrying the second ISS module, the Unity Node 1, in its cargo bay, rendezvoused with Zarya and its crew made of the two modules together. Over the next 13 years, 13 more modules were added to the space station. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look back at the devastating Spanish flu pandemic of 1918. Taiwan voters go to the polls Saturday for midterm local elections, seen as a test of the popularity for the two-year administration of President Tsai Ing-wen of the Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, which has favored a more independent path from China. The ballot also includes 10 referenda, including one that calls for a change in the name Taiwan uses for its athletic teams competing in international sporting events, from Chinese Taipei to Taiwan, a change that could rile mainland China. Bill Sharp is a longtime China and Taiwan analyst who hosts a Hawaii-based online program, Asia in Review. He spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty about the importance of the electoral outcome.
It seeks to fill over 11,000 local government positions, everything from the key races of the mayor of Taipei, the mayor of Taichung, the mayor of Kaohsiung, down to what you would call very low-level village folks. So it's rather massive, and the outcome of this will certainly have an effect on the upcoming presidential and legislative elections, which will be held in 2020.
Well, the DPP currently holds many local positions. Does it really just stand to lose? It probably won't gain very many more, will it?
Well, I think that there's a possibility that the DPP will lose maybe as many as four major positions.
Will the economy be the main issue?
Well, I think the economy is one, air quality is another. Of course, relations with China, which somebody would say means economic issue, are certainly the big ones. And probably not quite as pronounced as in other elections, the sense of Taiwan identity, but definitely air quality, economics, cross-strait or relations with China. These are going to be the big drivers.
There are a number of referendum on the ballot, one of which calls for Taiwan to change the name it uses at international sporting events. Will this be a big issue with China?
An enormous issue with China. This is the kind of thing that will set China off with no problem at all. But one has to realize, and I don't think that China realizes this, China insists that everybody in Taiwan is Chinese. But if you talk to people in Taiwan and ask them, are you Chinese or are you Taiwanese, 95% of the time they're going to say Taiwanese. Yes, their ancestors came to Taiwan 300 years ago, but these societies have evolved in very, very different ways. And I think that sometimes the mainland fails to fully grasp this.
The DPP's chief rival, of course, the Kuomintang, the KMT party, which has been seen as one that tries to accommodate Beijing. Is it hardening its position more to the DPP way of thinking?
Despite there being different, despite them having different ideas about Taiwan identity and relations with China, that actually in many ways they're very similar. What they call the light green and the light blue actually have a lot of common interests. Some issues like cross-strait relations, relations with China, and Taiwan identity can set them apart. I personally think that yes, okay, people in the Nationalist Party, at least some people, talk up a good story on unification. But when it comes right down to it, they really don't want it.
China and Taiwan analyst Bill Sharp. The Spanish flu outbreak of 1918 caused 50 million deaths worldwide. The pandemic was so severe that from 1917 to 1918, life expectancy in the United States fell by about 12 years to 36.6 years for men and 42.2 years for women. On this week's edition of Press Conference USA, host Rick Pantaleo joins VOA health reporter Carol Pearson in questioning Dr. Amesh Adalja from the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Adalja begins by describing the virus that caused the deadly outbreak.
The virus that was responsible for causing the 1918 pandemic was an influenza A virus that was new to the general population. It was an H1N1 that had its origin likely in an avian species. All the genes came directly from some avian species into humans, so that made it something that many people had no immunity to. There probably were some people that had seen something similar to it, but a great quantity of the population of the world had never seen a virus like it before, and that's what led to it having such a prolific spread and devastating impact.
Is it also called the swine flu?
We don't usually talk about it as a swine flu. I think that when you think about flu viruses, it can get a little complicated trying to keep avian and swine and human species separate. But what we do know is during 1918, there were hypotheses that maybe this originated in swine, but we've been able to now sequence that virus and see that it is of avian origin. That doesn't mean that swine weren't infected, and it's unclear what role they might have played in 1918, whether they were amplifying it, whether they were getting secondarily infected, or whether they may have been responsible. Maybe the virus went from birds to pigs and then to humans, or maybe it went directly from birds to humans. All of that really hasn't been established firmly. But in general, swine are very promiscuous when it comes to flu viruses. They can be infected by both human strains and avian strains, and they sometimes serve as what's called a mixing vessel, where the flu virus can kind of swap genes inside a pig, and that allows new combinations to occur and new viruses to emerge. And indeed, that's what we saw with the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, our last flu pandemic, where swine played such a major role. So in general, we try to use the word swine for viruses that emanate directly from a pig. In general, people have gotten away from it because there's a lot of misnomers that happen as well, because then people will start believing that pork products are infected, and you can have people causing major economic calamities based on the fact that something is called a swine flu when it really has little to do with the meat, but with the mixing vessel role of the pig.
Can you go over the history of the 1918 flu? It's been called the Spanish flu. It infected about a third of the world's population. Can you explain the spread, too?
You can't really talk about 1918 without really situating it in the broader context of what was going on at that time. And what was going on was the First World War. And that led the virus to be able to really exploit troop movements all over the world and spread very rapidly in a way that viruses prior to 1918 had a lot of difficulty doing. So that's sort of what's responsible for its spread. The reason why it's called Spanish influenza is kind of an interesting story. And it has to do with the fact that during World War I, many countries had censorship laws instituted where you couldn't write anything that might decrease the morale of the public. And because of that, a lot of the countries that had flu cases weren't really able to fully report it. So countries like Spain, which didn't have those laws on the books, were able to talk about this virus much more freely. And because of that, they were able to say that they had cases. And then kind of by circumstance, the virus became known as the Spanish flu. Of course, they didn't know it was a virus at that time, but the illness became known as a Spanish flu. Our best guess to the origin, and I think there's still a lot of hypotheses that are floating out, is that it actually probably originated in Kansas in the United States in a training camp is where more and more evidence is pointing to. So, in fact, it wasn't really a Spanish flu. It probably was an American flu.
Back in 1918, we saw the end of World War I. What was the effect and impact of the World War on the pandemic?
Well, the World War directly facilitated the spread of this virus as people were traveling back to their home countries. And you had mixing, you had training camps, you had lots of opportunities where the virus could have explosive spread. And if you read the history of 1918, you can hear these stories, for example, in Massachusetts, where there were training camps that were inundated with flu cases that really outstripped the ability to care for them. And I believe at that time, Calvin Coolidge might have been the governor of Massachusetts, and there was a he had asked for federal help from President Wilson. All of that was happening because of the fact that we had this clustering of people. And we know that viruses love to spread in closed populations, and we still see that in training camps for military, that we have certain viruses that can spread. And I think you can't think about 1918 without realizing that this World War and the troop movements and the troop gatherings and the mixing of people really was what facilitated this having that kind of an impact that no other flu pandemic had ever had in the past.
I understand the 1918 flu not only killed the young, old, and vulnerable, as flu does, but also healthy people, young people as well. Why did this happen?
Well, you have to think about, when you think about flu, we talk about what's called a U-shaped epidemic curve. So you see the cluster of the severe illness in the very young and in the very old. But in the pandemic of 1918, we had what was called a W-shaped epidemic curve, where you saw the old and the young affected, but also this peak in the middle, people in their prime of life that were getting affected. And that's something that's very characteristic of pandemic flus. And what it has to do with is the fact that people have this history with flu viruses. So viruses circulate, or something similar might circulate, and you get some immunity to it. And it just seemed that that group of people in the prime of life during 1918 had not seen a flu virus similar to that one that was responsible for 1918. So they were more disproportionately affected because their immune systems really were unprepared for it. And coupled with that, the fact that their immune systems are robust and during the prime of life, they tend to have an exaggerated response and cause a lot more damage than someone who's very young or very old because their immune system is much more powerful. So you take the fact that they were naive to that virus and they had very robust immune responses. You put those two things together, and they had very severe cases of infection where you had lots of destruction of the lungs, where you had secondary bacterial infections happening at a much higher rate than in the extremes of age.
Dr. Ames Adalja from the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. He was speaking with host Rick Pantaleo and VOA health reporter Carol Pearson. Listen to the full program, Press Conference USA, this weekend on VOA. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports, or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Green Book, by the filmmaker Peter Farrelly, tells the story of an unlikely friendship between two men from very different backgrounds, a world-renowned African-American classical pianist and an Italian-American bouncer from New York City. Their friendship develops during a concert tour in the American South during the 1960s, as they navigate their trip by consulting the Green Book, an annual guidebook written for African-American motorists, advising them where to safely sleep, eat, or travel at night during the Jim Crow era. VOA's Penelope Pulu reports on the dramatization of this real-life story.
I am not a medical doctor. I'm a musician. I'm about to embark on a concert tour in the Deep South. What other experience do you have?
Public relations.
Do you foresee any issues in working for a black man?
You and the Deep South, there's going to be problems.
Viggo Mortensen plays Tony Vallelonga, or Tony Lip, a New York City bouncer hired to drive and protect musician Don Shirley, an African-American from Manhattan, in the Deep South at a time when it was not safe for blacks to travel there. That's why they had to carry around the Green Book.
Now, this is the book I was telling you about. Now, sometimes you guys are staying in the same hotel, sometimes you're not.
Green Book is in reference to what was called the Negro Motorist Green Book.
It was a travel guide for African Americans during the 60s who would be traveling in the South.
It lists all places.
The Green Book, published annually from 1936 to 1966, listed services and places relatively friendly to African Americans. No matter how useful, as the film shows, the book could not completely shield the duo from harassment, even prison.
This gentleman says that I'm not permitted to dine here.
I'm afraid not.
How does he smile and shake their hands like that?
Because it takes courage to change people's hearts.
Screenwriter Nick Vallelonga, Tony Lip's son, incorporated stories his father had told him and also used real letters Tony Lip had written to his wife Dolores, with Don Shirley's help, during the tour.
May I? Dear Dolores, sometimes you remind me of a house.
You know this is pathetic, right?
Put this down. The distance between us is breaking my spirit. Falling in love with you
was the easiest thing I have ever done.
Filmmaker Peter Farrelly says that this real-life story illustrates the deep, long-lasting friendship that developed between the distinguished musician and the rough-around-the-edges driver. He says the lead actors struck a perfect balance in portraying the friendship that gave each knowledge and understanding of the other's perspective.
So if I'm not black enough, and if I'm not white enough, then tell me, Tony, what am I?
I knew, like, from the very beginning, no matter what happened to this movie, that there's going to be no movie this year with two better actors in it, too. And they're both at their top, you know, that's what's so impressive.
Some have criticized Farrelly for not offering a darker and more extended reference to the Negro Motorist's Green Book. They say its usefulness for 30 years shows the pervasiveness of legal discrimination not only in the southern states, but also in the north. It was originally written for the New York area. But the filmmaker says the heartrending levity in the film strikes a needed balance with the sinister backdrop of segregation. He says the real-life story and on-screen friendship is a testament to the human potential for universal understanding.
Pick it up, Tony.
Squirrels would eat it anyway.
Pick it up.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.